some people have been asking me, where did I get my name and all that kind of stuff, and I said I wanted to put it on tape because it's a good story. My brother, who is the eldest, and this fits our story here because this is the second child. I love the book of Genesis because the second child seems to get the upper hand. And with my brother, that was not always the case. My brother's name Bob Larson. And all I can say is my parents said, oh no, what did we do? Bob Larson. How many Bob Larsons are there in the world? So let's straighten this out. And they said, oh, dear, yes, that sounds like a good name. Reading the Bible, it goes good with Larson. So Darius, not in our family name at all, family tradition at all. And then we have the problem of looking at this little newborn infant, me, and calling it Darius. And I think they said, what did we do? And they went to Bonnie and then Kathy, the next two kids. I think I said this before, I've lived the first half of my life trying to live down that name. I did not like it. Kids razzed me about it. When somebody says Darius, I say, what is? You know, what? I was Delirious Darius, and then in seminary, I don't know if you remember, Delirious Darius is not with a denarius. that was added in seminary. But the second half of my life, which roughly, was trying to live up to that name. And I realized how important names are. Now, I don't know if with Esau, which means rough one, do you know what the name Jacob means? Jacob means one of two things. Heel holder, because Jacob came out, we will hear this, Jacob came out of the womb second, holding the heel of Esau, you know, almost as rough, trying to get out before him, you hang him back down, and you know, it must have been a wonderful delivery. Rebecca, if for anything else, should go down in history as having survived probably the most incredible delivery in the history of the world, with these two kids, as you kind of dramatize it, wrestling, trying to fight, and trying to get out first, you know, sort of stuff. It also means, Jacob also means one who deceives. So, what does that do to one's psyche? I'm glad Darius means one who sustains good thought. I like to think that that's what I do rather than one who deceives. We were listening yesterday to David Peters saying on business ethics, you almost get the feeling that sustaining good thought and deception are one and the same thing. I hope and pray it is not. Two comments. If I can put you on the, what's your name?
Eric.
I asked Eric when he came in this morning, what did he feel like after yesterday's talk? you know, this 12-year-old, I was just kind of curious. And he had some very good images and stuff about, oh, it depends on if Isaac kind of knew about this or not. And then I asked him, well, how about you, Eric? How would you have felt? And he said, I don't think I would have returned to bury him. I think you're right in there with me. The other is that the feeling that I think Abraham felt, and I know I really feel Isaac felt after that experience that leads us into today's story, is a feeling that a character named Rodriguez must have felt at the end of the novel by Usako Endo, Silence. And I just want to tell you briefly this story because it creates an interesting dilemma which is worth a whole discussion anyway. Sako Endo has written this book. Some people call him a Japanese Graham Greene. If it's in the bookstore, buy it. wonderful, wonderful. Anyway, he becomes a Jesuit, and he's going to go over to Japan to missionize the Japanese. And he wants to do this because when he was in, I think it's Spain, where he came from, he had this, in his church, this huge portrait or painting of Jesus there, either sitting or holding the world, I can't remember, but just got the whole world there. And he would pray to this image and pray to this image, but never did this image speak to him. So he went to Japan, and he was going to go to Japan, and there in Japan, he was going to really preach the word of God in such a way that he will be like the great ones before that's gone before him. He will become a martyr. He will be thrown into jail, because that's what happened to some of these evangelists back in those days. And he just couldn't wait for that day, and then he would know that he would be the right one. So he gets there and he does all of his work and all these sorts of things, and he discovers, sure enough, he's arrested and thrown into jail, and he is asked to apostatize. He is asked to deny Christ. And he says, you got to be kidding. I mean, he's much more dramatic than this. This is my embellishment. You got to be kidding. I could never do such a thing. Kill me. Oh, no. We're not going to kill you. Huh? You're not going to kill. Oh, no. Those people that you have brought to Christ, those are the people we're going to torture. Those are the people we're going to kill. We're going to keep doing it one by one by one until you deny Christ. All of a sudden, what he thought martyrdom was all about becomes something radically different. He hears night after night these torturous things going on. All of his friends who he's loved, who he's brought to Christ, dying. They bring out a picture of Christ, worn out by people stepping on it and rubbing their foot in it. That's what you're supposed to do. You know, I renounce you, or you have no power over me, or I, you know, whatever it is. And the picture was before Rodriguez, and for the first time in Rodriguez's life, Christ speaks to him and says, trample, trample, it is this that I have been brought into this world so that people like you can trample on me. And Rodriguez comes with this wonderful paradox, which is just haunting me still. Sometimes, to do the Christ-like thing, one has to deny the Christ. Interesting dilemma, don't you think? And he raises his foot, puts it on the picture of Christ, and walks away a broken man. Now you think that, you know, this is theology of glory, theology of the cross stuff, pure Lutheran good stuff, you know. You would think that the trumpets would blow, the heavens would part, and yay, we have a true, you know. He feels in the depths of his soul that he has betrayed Christ. He has lost his faith, and the rest of the book is just this interesting wandering around aimlessly, a beaten man. Isaac, after experiencing this, I think, is not the monarch that we would like Isaac to be. Isaac is this person who, in fact, all we know about his youth are two things. This experience we talked about yesterday, and that he was weaned from his mother. There's nothing else we know about Isaac until 20 years later now, and we are introduced to him along with his wife, Rebecca. That's chapter 24, which we're not going to get into, but it's a wonderful story. Do any of you know how Rebecca was chosen? And any of you know that story? It's the story. The servants go back up to Abraham's hometown to get a wife, and the servant says, I don't know, how am I supposed to select a wife for Isaac? And he says, I have an idea. What I will do is I'll stand by, this is now the well, okay? Stand by the well, looking thirsty. The first woman who comes to the well and offers not just me a drink, but my camels a drink, that will be the person that I will take back with me and will be Isaac's wife. Okay? So Harry stands there. This beautiful, gorgeous woman walks up. He's thirsty. She gives him water. This person happens to be named Rebecca. This person happens to be the daughter of Abraham's brother. And gives him water, and then what's left in the pitcher dumps in the trough for the camels to drink. This is quite easy. Not only that, as we learn about Rebecca on and on and on, Rebecca then runs back down, fills up the water, runs back uphill, dumps water into the trough, keeps going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. Kind of, you know, there are some people who just kind of, you think, overdo things. You know, Rebecca is this type of person who just, and you just want to slow down. But she keeps giving water so that the camels, you know, camels drink a lot of water, are no longer thirsty. So, you know, sometimes what you think you're looking for, you get and a lot more. This is Rebecca. So Rebecca comes back with the servants, and they're married, and we pick this up now. For the first time, Rebecca sees Isaac, and we see Isaac as an adult who is, his senses, he's old, I don't know what's his illness, he's near blind or blind, and probably a little hard of hearing, but let's just listen to the story here. I forgot who's reading it, but somebody is, and then we will discuss it.
This is the story of the descendants of Isaac, Abraham's son. Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah to be his wife, but Rebekah was barren. So Isaac prayed to the Lord, and Rebekah conceived twin sons. The children struggled and wrestled within her womb, and Rebecca cried to the Lord, "If this is the way it is to be, why do I exist?" And the Lord answered her, "Two nations are in your womb. One shall be stronger than the other, the older one serving the younger." So Rebecca gave birth to the twins, and the first to come out was named Esau, because he was ruddy and hairy all over. Then the brother emerged, holding on to Esau's heel, and they named him Jacob, the heel holder. Esau grew up to be a skillful hunter and a man of the fields, while Jacob was a quiet man who stayed in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he brought him savory game to eat, but Rebekah loved Jacob. One day Esau came home famished and faint from working in the fields, and Jacob convinced Esau to sell him his birthright for a bowl of stew. "What good is a birthright," Esau said, "if I'm at the point of dying?" As time passed, Isaac grew very old and his eyes too dim to see. He thought he was going to die. He beckoned Esau and said, "Go out to the field and bring me a meal of savory game that I love so that I may bless you before I die." Rebekah overheard Isaac's words and repeated them to Jacob. "Go fetch me two goats from the flock," she told her son, "and I will prepare the savory meal your father loves. When you take it to him, he will give you his blessing." "But Esau is a hairy man," Jacob said, "and I am smooth. Father will know I'm deceiving him and bring a curse on me, not a blessing." But Rebekah said, "Your curse will be on me. Just do as I say." Now Rebekah dressed Jacob in Esau's clothes and put the skins of the goats on his hands and neck. Jacob went to his father, and Isaac said, "Which son are you?" And Jacob said, "I am Esau, your firstborn. Let me touch you," Isaac said. "The voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau," and he blessed him. Jacob had scarcely gone out when Esau brought his meat to Isaac. Isaac began to tremble. "Who then was the man who brought me my meal before you? I ate it before you came and blessed him." And when Esau found out how Jacob had tricked them, he let out a bitter cry. "Oh, my father," he said, "my brother Jacob has conspired against me twice. First he took my birthright, and now my blessing. Don't you have one blessing left? Just one? Bless me too, oh my father." Isaac answered, "You will dwell in the fatness of the earth, but Jacob will be the master." From that day on, Esau hated his brother Jacob and vowed to kill him. Rebekah told Jacob to go. "Flee from your brother's fury," she said. "Run for your life."
Any parts of that story that are interesting, unique, something that just kind of popped out that you want to say, "I never thought of that before," or "What in the heck does this mean?" Just as you heard it.
Why couldn't he give a second blessing? I mean, what is involved in a blessing?
To bless is not the type of blessing that I give as a pastor in my congregation, where I, you know, just bless you people of God. It's not a blessing like, I don't even know some of you, but as a pastor, as a called and ordained pastor, I can do that. This type of blessing, the blessing in the Old Testament, is a totally different breed. Isaac may not have been distinguished as his father, but he has been blessed by God. Now he had to transmit this blessing from patriarch to patriarch to carry on a certain order, a certain way to weigh. And what the reading I've done, it basically says this, that as he has to transmit this blessing before he died, once uttered, the words of a blessing cannot be taken back. He was communicating his life's essence to his son, breathing his very soul into the other person. And to do this, Isaac gets closer, or Isaac asks, in this case, Jacob, who he thinks is Esau, to get closer. And as he gets closer, he has to kiss, feel the body, and smell the clothes. Blessing involves the body as well as the spirit here. It's not something that works automatically, but a patriarch is a person who's supposed to have a vision. A vision of what life can be, and he's supposed to proclaim that vision and make that vision into a reality. And what we have with Isaac is not so much a person of vision, but a person who has that vision, who just needs to pass it on to the next person. Abraham was definitely this person that had the vision and could see the picture. The blessed individual is a person who is supposed to live at the peak of his or her powers. In Genesis 1, blessing permeates the whole created order, linking us to all of nature. And with Noah, that washes out, and God chooses to work with one family now. God is trying to do, I mean, so there is a blessing in a sense, a universal blessing. But in this order, in the order of the patriarchal family with Israel, a blessing is passed on in a singular way from father, in this case, to son. It is intended to make a person feel at one with himself and the rest of the world. When this blessing happens, this blessing is supposed to set this person apart in such a way that this person can be the person to carry on the vision that was first given to Abraham. And thank God it tells you that no matter what, you are valued. Now, having said all that, I didn't answer your direct question, why can't you do that to more than one person? All I know is that's the way the tradition had it, that it could only be passed down. Now you notice as we get into Friday's talk with Joseph and Jacob, there are blessings to each of the kids. It is passed on a little bit more, but not the. It's like what we're going to be doing tomorrow. We're going to have a coronation. You don't have two kings. You have one king. So whoever gets this blessing is the king in that sense. Is the new patriarch. Now with Rebecca, you have probably the most forceful matriarch of all the matriarchs here. And I've thought, is that because Isaac is so weak? Do you have a weak? Yeah, I don't know. But it's interesting that she is such a forceful woman here. That's a long about way of tying in one thing I wanted to talk about, what is blessing. And we can also look at, if you turn to 27 and verse, starting with verse 27. This is the blessing. So he came near and kissed him and smelled the smell of his garments and blessed him and said, ah, the smell of my son is like the smell of a field that the Lord has blessed. May God give you the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Let people serve you and nations bow down to you. Be Lord over your brothers and may your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be in everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. Now to know that this blessing confers upon the receiver of the blessing all of that is powerful. The only problem we have here is that who does the blesser think he is blessing?
Esau.
And who is literally being blessed here?
Jacob.
There's a problem. Might it be that Jacob is an imposter? Might it be that Jacob, how would you, have you ever gotten something that you know you've kind of twisted a little truth, connived a little bit? You wanted mom or dad to think that you were a little nicer than your brother or your sister or something, and so you set it up in such a way that really wasn't quite fair. Have you kind of, you've all kind of experienced something like this in your life? How does whatever you get, how does it feel? Does it feel wonderful?
Yeah.
Feels cheap? What else does it feel sometimes?
Well, if you really don't have it.
But you really don't have it. Yeah. I think that Jacob longs to have his father truly bless him as himself. And his father dies before he can do that. So he's got to live with this blessing. But you do love, you do feel cheap. You do feel, at least the times I shouldn't speak autobiographically, but when it's happened to me, I've felt like it's not really the way it's supposed to be. There's something rotten in the state of deadlock.
That's why it was so important for him to have the dream of the ladder, where he actually receives the blessing directly from God.
Yeah, yeah.
So that he that it's not something that is unreal.
Didn't God say at the beginning to Rebecca that the second is going to control the first?
Yes. And that's maybe why Rebecca thinks that. That's why Rebecca plays favorites here, probably. But nowhere do we know if Rebecca shared this with anybody. I would think if I was Rebecca, I would want to sit down with my husband and try to talk this one out. And say, but because the husband is Isaac here, is really still preferring Esau, it makes me think that either he didn't believe Rebecca, which could be the case. Rebecca, by the way, did I tell this? That this is the first time that a question that is asked by a woman directly to God gets an answer in the Bible. That, why is this going on inside me? Do I have to put up with this? I might as well be dead. And the Lord says, no, because two nations are living within you. You're going to have twins. And the younger will be, what did I say, the ruler? Or the older will be to have the power over the older. I find that very interesting. We just don't know. We just don't know, however, if God passes on to other people or if Rebecca passes on to other people. It is just silent. Yes?
Is this another case of people helping fulfill God's promises, just as Sarah sort of meddled and tried to, you know, make it happen? So it's kind of trying to make it work out the way.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I was troubled with that conversation whenever we had it yesterday, the day before, all of those days. What else are we supposed to do?
Right.
If we don't meddle, what do we do? I'm going to be God's will. What does that mean? We have to do something. We have to have provisional hunches. There's this image by, whoever wrote it, it's a Christian ethics book, a Lutheran. Talks about the river of life. Life is like a river that flows through life. And grace is seen where you think God is present and jumping in and embracing God in the hungry, the poor, in church, in choirs, in whatever. And you jump there. Sometimes when you jump, you realize that, whoops, and you get back up on the bank and you look for God again. Cheap grace is standing on the riverbank and saying, there goes God. There goes God. Because you're scared stiff to jump in, because you could be wrong. I think meddling, which is a good word, is precisely what we are supposed to do. Hopefully discerning where we think God is, and where we think God is, Rebecca has to act here. God has told her what's going to happen, and it doesn't seem like it's happening the way she thought God said it was supposed to happen. So I got to do something here. I got to get Jacob to switch places with Esau here. So is that humans meddling in God's affairs? In hindsight, it's always easy to say that. But in foresight, it's probably what we're called to do. And that's the tension. Yes?
Sometimes there gets to be a conflict between the fundamentalist people today who say God will provide, God will take care of it, and those who might present the argument that God's given us a mind and reasoning abilities and expects us to do as much as we can for ourselves. I've run into those kinds of conflicts.
I have a seminary prof who has his a poster. I had a seminary prof years ago. Had a poster in the back of his desk that says, "God, prayer does not replace common sense. Common sense is a God-given gift that God expects you to use. So use it." So that would be my answer to some of it. But sometimes common sense is just not enough. And I can see doing this or doing this or doing this or doing this are all make sense to me. Or sometimes doing this doesn't make sense, but God somehow tells me this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And that's where that discernment is really a part of it all. Yeah?
I think part of what we find troubling in this business of tradition, is that it doesn't fit in with our notion of contract. a contract is you have to have a consideration, and you have to have understanding, mutual understanding of what you're getting into. And if you get involved in something, you can later claim, this isn't what I understood, this isn't the way it was presented, and you got an out. But you really got me thinking. It's not you who chose me, but I who chose you. So these are the chosen people. They could have been anybody else, but they happen to be this tribe. Mm-hmm. And guess what, ladies? God sets you into, set us all into, a patriarchal operation. And that needs lots of adjusting all the time. Mm-hmm. Everything you've been saying, it's a stacked deck from the beginning. It isn't a contract. And it's a stacked deck, and if Sarah doesn't meddle, and if Rebecca doesn't meddle, and if all of us don't meddle, we're just a group of victims. I don't think that's what God meant.
Mm-hmm. And it may not be a contract, but it is a covenant, and there's a difference between covenant and contract there, which I felt, you know, like God will, no matter what we do, no matter if we meddle right or wrong, God's going to hang in there with us. Did you have a comment?
Just that our understanding, the human understanding of what the law is in terms of the birthright, is actually the breaking of that law is facilitated by God, inspired by God. And I find that something in the Old Testament to be interesting, because I always think the Old Testament is always supporting the, you know, kind of a law sort of theology, but is this kind of an illumination of how God breaks through what we say, this is the order of things, this is how it should be, and says, no, not necessarily, you know, things are going to get shaken up when I'm around, what you think, the pattern's going to change.
It may not only be blessed deception, but it may be blessed disobedience too, mm-hmm. in that sense. Disobedience to something that we confuse as God, and God wants to say that this is not God. That's very true. Just a footnote running forward to the 70s and 80s. I am so frustrated with the fact that there has to be such a thing as conscientious objection. Why isn't there conscientious participation? Why is it that the burden of proof always has to be on those who object to war versus those who participate, for example, in war? Why do we always have to, well, I said that, and that's not part of this. We got to get going. Anything else before we get back to the text that is in any of your heads?
I was thinking that Rebecca's deception or manipulation resulted in a curse on her because she never sees her son again. Her two sons are forever estranged. Mm-hmm. And had she maybe waited for more guidance from God or let God unfold his plan, it might have resulted in
God's plan works no matter what happens, how whoever are the pawns or the people in the play. And what it tells me is just because God's will is done doesn't mean life will be happy ever after. That life is life. Life is full of, that's what we said yesterday, life is full of pain, life is full of misunderstandings, life is full of grief, life is full of joy, beauty, and that stuff too. But what it tells me is that just because Rebecca was faithful, or meddling, we don't know whichever interpretation, but let's say if she was faithful, it doesn't mean she gets the Rolls Royce. That those who are blessed in this sense does not mean that they are going to get the big house, that they're going to win the lottery, but they will have anguish, but they will also be blessed because they know that they have done what they thought was the will of God. And once again, there's room there to understand later that what I thought was the will of God wasn't the will of God. So I want life to tell me that if I could just understand this book enough, I would be able to live that life of holiness that would mean that I would be blessed with all these other sorts of things.
That is one of the things that I think is fatalistic in some ways, because there is no possibility that any one person can take in all of the conundrums in this book and sort of make a scheme of it that works.
Well, somebody is. It's a bestseller now. I haven't read it yet. The code book or whatever it's called.
Oh, Bible code.
Yeah, the Bible code. I mean, have any of you read that?
No.
I'm just interested how it's on the bestseller list too, to try to figure out. But that's more of a book of prophecy versus a book on how you're supposed to live. Yeah. So it's different than your point.
This is one of the challenges that we have to live with. That there are always new ways. Everyone is experiencing a new frontier.
Uh-huh.
And everyone who looks at the book, each of us is going to read this differently. And none of us are going to say, I have, or dare say, but dare not say, I have the right answer.
To do a little bit of a digression, which I think is the essential nature of this book, I think, is that Luther talks about dead word and living word. In fact, he talks about the Bible. This watch now is Jesus. I'm holding the Bible in my hand. I'm folding it. This is for the tape. I'm folding it into a V shape, and I'm placing Jesus into the book. The book is the manger that holds the Christ. The point isn't to understand the perfections or imperfections of the manger and where it is flawed or not flawed. The purpose of the manger is to reveal the living Christ. The purpose of the manger is to somehow to help us see who Jesus is. If you do not see the Christ in the manger is a dead book.
See, I have a little difficulty with that, because I think we are apt, when we say to see the Christ, that we are apt to separate the Trinity and make Jesus the God rather than God.
Uh-huh.
And so I think the book is there to help us reveal God,
mm-hmm.
and Jesus is part of that whole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we have to watch ourselves that, because I think because Jesus was a man, we have to make God too anthropomorphic,
mm-hmm.
and God is much greater than that. And I think this is really what Genesis is saying. God, there is such a God, so immeasurable, so incomprehensible,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we find it too easy to see God as Jesus only.
And I would agree with that, but what Luther was dealing with here was against kind of a Bible-ology, and what you're challenging is a Jesus-ology. And if you noticed, I did not use the word Jesus, I used the word Christ, but your point is still... It's still well taken. We are to receive God through this, and that God should change us. And the point here, how does God change us? I can tell you that the sky is blue-gray. And with some discussion, we could somewhat agree that it's gray-blue, blue-gray today. But that doesn't change your life. It doesn't force you to live your life differently in any sort of way, unless it's purple silver or something, maybe. But the question, will you marry me, demands a response. What, in studying scripture, what one needs to do is study it in such a way that those living words, as you call them, pop out at us and demand some sort of response from us, so that we are in relationship with that text. And what we have here in Genesis is all sorts of things which tell me that when I'm in relationship with what I see as the God of this text, is that life isn't just a bed of roses. That life is full of all sorts of problems, all sorts of joys. And we see a wrestling match, let's say. And that's where we are here. Maybe I should get back to here before our time is all over. Where should I go? Let's imagine ourselves here as Rebecca. Okay, we got an image of Rebecca here, a very forceful, strong, matriarchal woman who just doesn't shut up and adjust, but keeps pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. Now, if you can imagine yourself as Rebecca, how do you justify your actions? How do you tell what you expect? How do you explain what you expect from each of your sons? Does that make sense? Should I try it a different way? If you're Rebecca, what worries you the most? If you're Rebecca, what worries you more is that Esau may get the blessing? Is that what worries her the most, or would it be something else? Well, let's go with that one then. Yeah?
That maybe if Esau gets the blessing, that she'd be letting God down for not getting Jacob the blessing. That's what God said.
It was very clear to her that Esau was not supposed to get the blessing, that Jacob was supposed to get the blessing. And so she has to do everything she can. She has to, I love that word, meddle. She has to meddle in the affairs in order to get what she thinks God wants.
Couldn't she have said to Isaac, hey, I got this message from God, and he says the second son is supposed to get your blessing?
You could have. And maybe you did, but see, you're Rebecca now, but you did not, you somehow it's not in this text, we don't know that. And if so, how would that have made your husband feel? He's the person who's supposed to have all these divine visions, and
it's a patriarch.
And God has been so incredibly silent to him, that he's not sure what this is all about anyway. The last time that he has had any divine revelation from God was when the angels told Abraham to stop with the knife. Now, should I bring up as Rebecca this image of God speaking again? Or should I just try to just kind of do it my way? Is this the first time that a woman's been branded manipulative?
I think we're leaving out the fact that Rebecca was just maybe wanting her own way, because it says that Isaac loved Esau, but Rebecca loved Jacob. Maybe she was looking out for herself, because after Isaac left, she would be cared for by the son.
Uh-huh.
And it was Jacob that she had the relationship with, not Esau. So was she really carrying out anything that she believed was God's will, or was she carrying out her will?
Yeah. All I know, and it could very well point, the only thing I would think of is that this dream, this vision, this conversation, this answer from God came before she even knew which one would come out first. So somehow, if you want to take this story, and whether or not when this came to her or whatever, if you want to take it in a chronological order, that would have given her a little bias towards the second son, for sure, or a big bias towards the second son, and therefore everything else that you say definitely would follow from that. Yes.
On the other hand, she did say she was willing for the curse to be placed on her. Mm-hmm. When Jacob said, you know, I'll be cursed, perhaps, instead of blessed, he said, let the curse be laid.
That's a good point. There's not too many people that we have encountered in this Bible who is willing to take responsibility for their actions. Eve made me do it. The serpent made me do it. Cain and Abel, you know. Cain kills Abel because Abel was, God was for showing favorites. Here she says, I'm willing to take the responsibility here. I'm willing. I mean, that's a gutsy woman.
Yeah.
Good point. What was that? Moving on to, do you think Rebecca was overbearing, manipulative? Do you think she was feisty or all of the above? Or, as you say, this is a patriarchal society, and how is she different than the other women that we've encountered so far in the book of Genesis?
Less passive?
That's an understatement. She's less passive.
She's a good understudy to Sarah.
She what?
Good understudy to Sarah.
Yeah?
But it's the only way they could survive. She had to do that.
Well, not only that, she is, Was that?
I guess my sense from her, I think she has a vision of the future, and she's discriminating between these sons about who's going to be the better leader. And, with the sanction of the visit from God, it just seems so, there seems to be a kind of wisdom about this. Esau throws away the birthright for a cup of soup, you know.
What is the birthright?
I think I thought it was something much more than I think what it is. The birthright is who's ever the firstborn gets it all, gets the stuff.
The farm, so to speak.
Yeah, right, so, right.
So isn't this giving of the blessing to Jacob just a furthering of that?
Yeah. Except for, can you actually give away your birthright? I don't, just help me here. Pardon?
I'm sure you could.
The wisdom of a 12-year-old. You're right on.
She ate the soup.
Yeah. But okay. Anybody can help us with birthright, but I don't want to lose her point in that. And her point, as I understand it, is that here we have from this one example. Well, let's go back. Esau is what? What's his profession?
Hunter.
Pretty good at it too, I guess. Yeah. In fact, Jacob likes. Isaac likes Jacob. Isaac likes Esau because he likes the meat that he brings to him. Right? Okay. I have this portrait of this incredible Hulk. Lisa, I'm hungry. Give me some of that red stuff. Red stuff. The word stuff is the same word that they use when they are feeding cattle. Animal feed. He doesn't even know how to call it stew. Give me some of that red stuff. On the other side, give me first your birthright. The articulate, the together, the person who's, what's his occupation?
Lawyer.
Well, maybe we can call him a lawyer, but
The one who knows how to deceive. But he's one who does what all day? What is a tent sitter?
Who's a quiet man living in tents?
Yeah, that's what he does. I'm a quiet man. Oh, excuse me. I'm a quiet man. Who lives in tents? What was that?
Teaches philosophy.
Oh, no, David Peters was here in the first session. He must have been a philosopher.
You have the wild man opposed to the civilized. The tent was.
Well, that's
the impression.
It's a caricature, but. Mm-hmm. Huh? You know, is this person who calls stew red stew fitting to be the patriarch? Might Rebecca be sensing something different between about these two? These people are supposed to be twins. Came out hairy and red. Oh, yes.
Another angle, and the last part of 26 mentions that Esau had married two women. It looks like they might not have been Jewish women.
They were not only they were Hittites.
They were a disappointment. Yeah. It says a bitter disappointment to Isaac and Jacob. So he's already shown some signs of poor judgment.
Oh yeah, yeah. He could get you. Know, yeah. Can this dream of you know all of what has come before, you know, the whole creation story coming all the way down to Noah, and now God chooses this one family, and now in some cases, however, I would believe, because of all the other louses that God has chosen and has worked wonders with, maybe I've been the best choice. I mean, we talked in the first hour, Peter was this kind of this put your foot in your mouth type of guy too. You know, not quite the same character, but similar. And God's able to do wonders with people like you and me. Mm-hmm. Thank God. Yes.
Let me suggest that it might be that Jacob needed God's grace a lot more than Esau, because Esau was not interested in power as much as Jacob was, or possession.
Mm-hmm. Very true. I don't know if one needed it more, but the case is that he needed it for the reasons you gave it. I would totally concur with it. Yes.
Birthright is three things. It's
good. You looked it up. Yes.
Pass on to the eldest son at the father's death the blessing of the father, the leadership of the family, and a double share of the inheritance. So he doesn't get all the stuff. He gets twice as much as the other sons get.
Uh-huh.
Only in a few cases, like Job's daughters, where his inheritance is passed on to the women. But, so it's not everything. Uh-huh. So I've still got a couple of sheep or something. And secondly, I want to take the unpopular view and attack.
Excuse me, but back to the birthright then. To sell your birthright, you can do that, but but what is necessary in order for that to happen is you still have to receive your father's blessing on that. And that's, he doesn't have that yet.
Yes.
Even
right.
If you have that, right. You still need the blessing. Yes. Otherwise,
yes. Yes. Jacob had to do the second
step. Right. Right. Okay. Go. Yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead.
It's interesting though that the birthright was a sibling arrangement that had nothing to do with Isaac. That transfer.
Right. Well, Isaac wasn't hungry, probably. I know your point. Yeah.
This was something that they agreed upon way beforehand, before the blessing.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
so
true.
So they set it in motion way back.
Yeah. Yeah.
But okay. Then Rebecca and Sarah both, I think, their stories are here because they're the dramatic little stories in their lives. Obviously, there's a lot of life that they live more mundanely. But I think they're here as sort of a counterexample to us, at least through trying to find a good example where somebody, where common sense is the wrong course. And there is one. It's David. He counts the people against God's will. But there's another one too, and that is Saul. Saul's downfall was when he failed to slaughter all of the whoever they were, and he came back and Samuel met him, if you recall, and said he didn't kill all those people and the sheep. And Saul said, "Oh, we just kept the good ones." I mean, nothing wrong with the sheep. And God has said, do it. And Saul's common sense that God, you couldn't really have meant that, turned out to be his last act as king. So I think Rebecca and Sarah here also are, yes, applying common sense, and they're becoming the tools of God to get something done, but that they each suffered from that. Yeah. As pointed out back here, it looks like Rebecca lost contact with both her kids, and Sarah also lost contact with her children. So God undoubtedly would have accomplished it another way, and it might not have made a good story. There might be a whole bunch of those things that happen that don't make it here because they're not good stories.
Or, and this may be more radical, or is people of God, this is the timeline now, okay, I'm going way over here, people of God trying to understand, now we are a people. How do we get here? Then we get back to today's story with Rebecca, Isaac, and Jacob, and Esau. And we start seeing connections in hindsight. Don't you see how God has worked in your life? In the midst of it, you don't have the foggiest idea. At least I don't have the fog. Sometimes I think I do. But it's with that depth looking back, I go, you know, God really was with me at this moment. I can really see those connections. And people of faith can try to sort through all of that stuff to help us understand. I'm convinced that when my dad died at age 59 of a heart attack, I grew closer to God. God did not cause my dad to die at age 59 so that I could have a growth experience. But for people of faith, they can see how God is a part of their life in no matter what happens. And that's what the people of Israel are doing here in trying to understand their stories. They are trying to weave their lives into God's lives and see how that is the same life. We have this image. Somebody mentioned the Bethel Bible series in the first session, and they have the red line. We think that this is that God works in some sort of red line, one step here, 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 and you become this robot. If anything, and I want Dan Erlander to finish this, he started this about 20 years ago, he calls it the red line of orthodoxy. And his red line that he's drawing is just going all over the place. And what we think in hindsight is this orthodox way is all sorts of battles, the tugs and pushes all around. And the red line is nothing but straight. Except for we know that somehow it's that Holden prayer, that God's hand. How does it go? Help us go out with good courage, not knowing where we go, but God's hand is
leading
us and guiding us. His love supporting us. Help us go out with good courage. I mean, it's powerful, powerful stuff. Oh, where are we in this text? Oh, this is not where we are, but I just saw it. On page 1, first verse of 25:21, there are four things that start this off. Rebecca is barren. When I read that, after reading all this stuff about Sarah, I thought, here we go again? Here we go again? Come on, God! What's all this infertility doing here? But then what happens? In that same verse, Isaac prays to the Lord. The Lord grants his prayer, and Rebecca conceives. That's a lot quicker than the last time. One verse. Boom. Not 25 years, 9 chapters. I don't know. I just saw that.
It was 20 years, though.
Huh?
It was 20 years.
It was 20 years. I know. But do that. Good point. We see it in one verse, but it was really they were married for 20 years before they conceived. So there was something else going on there. But it's compressed space, at least in this story.
Does infertility in these stories suggest that there's no children born or that there's no males born?
The ones I know of, there's no children. But I would say that for the rightful heir, they were looking for a male. So in this case, Sarah, because they do list, by the way, when Sarah dies, Abraham remarries and has 6 kids, is it?
Or 10 more.
10 more?
Yeah.
12. Yeah. 10 more kids. Any guys that are, 175 years old? yeah, good question. I really don't know the answer to that, but my assumption is, especially if Abraham and Sarah, there would have been some sort of statement made, because A, it proves that they're not infertile, I would think. And B, we got this beautiful daughter, but we're still waiting for the son. There's none of that.
Jacob's wife, uh-huh. The first one that was given to her, has a daughter. So I think the very fact that it is mentioned there suggests that there were no women.
I might not tell you the name or anything like that, but they'll say it happened.
No, it doesn't give the name.
Anyway, in conclusion, those who want to stick around longer, and I'm sorry that we didn't get to the end of this story, but the end of the story is that Esau, one of the most pathetic lines in Scripture, "Daddy, do you have a second blessing?" Or better, in character, "Dad, do you have a second blessing?" You know something. It's this. I know I've been foiled here. This kid, my younger brother, always does this to me. Always gets the one up. I hate my brother. I'm going to kill him. And then, of course, he has to split. And we come back with the big wrestling match and the ladder and all that. Yes?
Maybe Esau wasn't that stupid. And when he knew that he was giving Jacob his birthright, that Jacob would still have to get the blessing. So Esau wasn't really worried when he gave him the birthright.
Yeah. And was his dad fooled? Here's this long section in here that talks about, come a little closer. Who do you sound like?
Jacob.
Who do you smell like?
Esau.
Who do you feel like?
Esau.
You know? Might, wonderful possible interpretation here. Might of Jacob known, or I should say might of Isaac known, that Jacob was the rightful person. How can I tell my son who I love so much that you're not cut out to be this patriarch? Rebecca sure has been arguing this line all the time. So might, this is one speculation, might the two of them figure this stuff all out as a way of saving face and blank, and Rebecca says, I'll take full responsibility, dear. I will bear the burden here. So we conspire, and it's a blessed deception all against Esau. Maybe not. It's just an interesting little twist there. I don't think Esau was so dumb, back to your point. And I surely don't think Isaac was so dumb either. Isaac may have been a wimp, but he was not dumb.